Flashman and the Redskins by George MacDonald Fraser. Continued. Cassette 10, Side 2. It was a pale ghost named Flashman who eventually waved her a feeble goodnight as she carefully gathered up her attire and departed with a whispered, "Yep, okay," as the door closed. I wondered weakly if I'd ever known the like. Yes, a thousand times, but surely never with such a cool, unhurried efficiency. It became clear why she wouldn't play during the day. There'd never have been a stroke of work done, and she'd have had a corpse on her hands by tea time. Well, it promised to be a most satisfactory cruise, and with the distant throb of the paddle wheel to lull me, I was drifting off to sleep when another noise, muffled but closer at hand, began to pull me slowly back to consciousness. I listened drowsily, the hairs on my neck beginning to rise. No, I must be mistaken. It must be some murmur of the boat, and not what I thought it was at first. The sound, faintly through the panels from Mrs. Candy's cabin, of deep sobbing. Chapter 19. If you care to examine the log of the Far West, you will find an exact account of her voyagings on the Missouri and Yellowstone in the days that followed. But for my purpose, the barest facts will do. A glance at the map will show you how it was. She was bringing the forage and gear for Terry's column, which had struck due west from Fort Lincoln across the Dakota Territory for the mouth of the Powder River. Advancing to meet them from the west along the Yellowstone were old Gibbon and his Walker heaps. And they were to join forces and push down into the wild country between the Bighorn and the Powder to find the hostile bands who were in there somewhere. No one had much notion where, for it was territory that only a few bold scouts and trappers had ever penetrated. Crook, with a third column, was traipsing about somewhere to the south, out of touch with Terry, but as Custer had told me, the hostiles would be effectively hemmed in by the three forces. Now, you'll wonder if I was wise to be fornicating carelessly on a boat that was going so near to the scene of operations. But it didn't look like that at all from the warm embrace of Mrs. Candy, or from the hurricane deck of the Far West, as she thrashed up the Missouri to Fort Buford, and then into the beautiful grove-lined valley of the Yellowstone. For one thing, there wasn't going to be any fighting worth the name, beyond a skirmish or two, if some of the hostile bands proved recalcitrant. And that would be far to the south of the Yellowstone, with a large and efficient army in between. In fact, it was quite jolly to be on the fringe of the action, so to speak, in the perfect safety of a comfortable steamboat, where one could loaf and stuff and yarn with Marsh and the boys, and gorge oneself with candy after dark, if you'll pardon the pun, and lie snug and cozy listening to the churning of the great wheel. The Yellowstone is one of the finest river valleys I know, with its woodlands and islands and quiet inlets and clear rippling waters. Sometimes you might think yourself on the Thames, and an hour later you're steaming between grand red bluffs, as unlike England as anything could be. It was a prime holiday altogether, and the president of the corporation improved with every performance, although she still remained as impersonal as ever during the day. I'd suppose that after Fort Buford she might unbend a little. After all, by then I'd absorbed all there was to know of her Bismarck scheme, and seen the kind of country to be settled. I'd even drafted, with a straight face, a letter to Otto explaining the thing and inviting his approval. God alone knew what he'd make of it if it ever reached him, with my moniker on it. Mrs. Candy commended it briskly and said she'd submit it to her directors, and I thought, first rate. Now we can get to know each other socially as well as carnally. But not a bit of it. It was still B for business from breakfast till dinner, with her making notes and sketches of the Yellowstone country, like a good little land speculator. And anyone seeing us on deck or in the saloon would have taken us for fellow passengers who were formerly polite and no more. I didn't much mind. There was even a strange excitement in knowing that this sharp, no-nonsense Yankee businesswoman, all efficiency and assurance, could turn into the most wanton of concubines when the blinds were drawn. I say concubine because she was by no means a lover. She'd talk civilly enough, without much interest, between bouts, but there was none of the intimacy you find in a mistress or even a high-quality whore. How much she enjoyed our couplings was hard to say. How much does a hopeless drunkard enjoy drinking? There was a hungry compulsion that drove her, always in that intense, deliberate way, like an inexorable, beautiful machine. Ideal, from my point of view, but then I'm a sensual brute, and I dare say if she'd been warm or loving, I'd have tired of her sooner. As it was, the cold passion with which she gave and took her pleasure demanded nothing but stamina. With the other men on board, she was politely discouraging. One or two of the army officers whom we took aboard for short stages were disposed to be gallant, and short shrift she gave them. One, I'm sure, had her heel stamped on his instep, for I saw him follow her onto the foredeck one evening, only to return red-faced and hobbling visibly. Marsh and his mate, Campbell, must have known how it stood with Candy and me, but tactfully said nothing. Marsh was a splendid sort of capital pilot and skipper, and tough as they came, I guessed, but with a fund of yarns and partial to a convivial glass, or a hand at euchre. It was about 10 days out of Bismarck that we came to the Powder Mouse, where a great military camp was taking shape. With the arrival of Terry's advance guard, and Gibbon only a few days' march away, there was tremendous work and bustle. The Far West was back and forth, ferrying troops and stores and equipment. Her steerage was a bedlam of men and gear, while our deck was invaded by all manner of staff wallopers in search of comfort. Terry held his meetings in the saloon. Messengers went galloping pell-mell along the banks. A forest of tents and lean-tos sprang up in the meadows. The woods rang and hummed with the noise of men and horses. Rumours of Indian movement far to the south were discussed and as quickly discounted. No one knew what the blazes was happening. Indeed, it was like the beginning of any campaign I'd ever seen. Terry seemed pleased, if surprised, to see me, and preserved his amiable urbanity when I presented him to Mrs. Candy. His staff men eyed her with lascivious respect, and me with envy. Marsh had explained our presence, and since Far West could carry far more passengers than there were staff, no objections could be raised. Indeed, Terry made no bones about talking shop with me. We'd got on well at Camp Robinson, and I sensed that he was anxious about his new responsibilities. He'd never campaigned against Indians, and regarding me as an authority on the Sioux, poor soul, and knowing I'd smelled powder on the frontier, he canvassed me in his quiet, cautious way. Not about his duties, you understand, but on whether Spotted Tail might have talked sense to the hostiles during the winter, and the possibility of defections to the agencies. Something else was troubling him, too. "George Custer hasn't shaved since we left Abe Lincoln," he confided. "A small thing enough, but it worries me. I've never known him so melancholy and restless. I begin to wonder if I was wise in urging Grant to let him come." "Nerves," says I. "Get the doctor to give him a purge. George is like a cat on hot bricks about this campaign, and a fortnight's trekking over empty prairie won't have improved his temper. Give him work, and you'll see a difference." He made a lip. "I've a notion between ourselves that secretly he resents my authority. I only hope he'll behave sensibly and not imagine he can be a law unto himself, do you know?" I asked what he'd heard, and he said nothing, really, beyond a feeling that Custer regarded Terry's job as the transport and supply of the 7th Cavalry, who could be left to take care of the soldiering on their own. I assured Terry that all cavalry commanders talk that way, and cited my old bête noir, Cardigan, who had resented the least interference from his superiors. "He was the man who led your light cavalry at Balaclava, wasn't he?" says Terry thoughtfully. And after that he seemed rather withdrawn, and presently went to bed with a hot toddy. I raised an eyebrow myself when the boy general arrived a few days later, all brave in fringed buckskin and red scarf over his uniform, but with a face like a 2-day corpse. He came striding up the gangplank, barking orders to his galloper, slapping his gloves impatiently against his legs, brightened momentarily at sight of me, and went straight into a nervous fret because Libby wasn't aboard. "Why didn't you bring her?" he demanded pettishly. "Who said she should not come?" He was bright-eyed with strain and hollow-cheeked under his four-week beard. His hair had been close-cropped and he looked even leaner and more worn than in Washington. "It's too bad, as if I hadn't had checks enough." I told him Terry was in the saloon and he snorted and strode off to berate Marsh for leaving Libby behind. From then on, the Far West was like a hotel come orderly room. Staff men were working in the saloon all day, and several chaps from the 7th, including Tom and Boston Custer, as well as Terry's party, occupied berths. Mrs. Candy kept a good deal to her cabin, but I had to endure any number of digs and sallies from the fellows. I told them they were a young army yet, and hadn't learned about campaign equipment. Her presence gave Custer another excuse to abuse Marsh over Libby. He didn't berth aboard, but had his tent pitched on the bank. "Our buckskin Achilles," grunts Benteen, grinning at me over his pipe. Now, as the expedition moved leisurely up the Yellowstone, I was enjoying life hugely. I could watch the martial activity ashore, hobnob with the boys in the saloon, play poker in the evenings, drink hearty, pile into Mrs. Candy by night. Terry, bless him, allowed no late carousing, and all was snug down by midnight. Listen to the professional gossip, and reflect contentedly that for once it was nothing to do with me. When the column swung south into the blue, I'd be left safely behind to loaf and Roger in these idyllic surroundings. I can't recall when I've been in better fettle. For now, the grip was coming as the columns converged. At the mouth of the Tongue, we halted, under the high bluffs to the north, with the troops camped on an old Toronto. By this word, Flashman presumably means an Indian meeting place. The area is now the site of Miles City, Montana. On the south bank, where there were many Sioux burial platforms, mostly broken and derelict, but some quite new, and the troops thought it great sport to scatter them to bits. I remarked in Terry's hearing that it was bad medicine. For one thing, his Ree and Crow scouts wouldn't like it, and he ordered it stopped. If you wonder why I put in my oar, I'll answer that I've soldiered far and hard enough to learn one invariable rule, superstition or not, never monkey with the local gods. It don't pay. And now the expedition began to buzz with definite news at last of hostiles far to the south. Reno had been off on a scout and had found an abandoned campground where there had been several hundred teepees, as well as a heavy trail heading west towards the Bighorn Mountains. Custer was in great excitement at this. "The hunt is up," says he, and was off with the 7th to meet Reno at the Rosebud Mouth. Far West was there ahead of him, and I was on the hurricane deck, watching his long blue column jingling down under the trees to bivouac, when I found Mrs. Candy at my elbow. Making chat, I asked her what she thought of Custer. "They say he has good political connections," says she indifferently. "Yep, I wouldn't do business with him." "Oh, why ever not? In business, you have to be able to rely on people, not to say trust them, just to know how they'll act. Okay, I wouldn't rely on him. He's crazy." "Good Lord, what makes you say that?" "He likes killing Indians, doesn't he?" She shrugged. "That's what I hear. I suppose he means to kill a lot of them up there." She gestured idly towards the low brown bluffs to the south. Her costume today was of some pale material, and the eye patch contrasted vividly with that rich, dusky rose complexion, which had taken on a most becoming tint from the Yellowstone sunshine. I said, well, he was a soldier, and so was I for that matter, and she turned her cold, appraising eye on me. "Killing for a living, yep. I suppose your conscience gets used to it." "Just as it does in business, I imagine." "Business? It depends what kind of deals you make, yep."
And as bustle broke out below, with bugles sounding and Marsh bawling orders to warp the Far West to the south bank, she turned away in bored fashion and went down to her cabin. That was June the 21st, and in the evening Terry issued marching orders to his commanders at one of the strangest staff conferences ever I saw. Since it was a vital moment in the Sioux campaign, and every survivor has recorded his recollections of it, not just who said what, but who understood what, or didn't, or sneezed, or scratched his backside, I must do the same. For I was there, as who the devil wasn't, except perhaps the ship's cook and the cat. When Terry summoned the senior men, the journalist fellow stood his ground in the saloon, and Mrs. Candy continued to leaf idly through a magazine in her seat at the forward end, within easy earshot. So I found myself a lounging place against the bulkhead, where I could overlook the map on the main table. Terry, spruce and affable, sat in the centre, smiling round with his short-sighted blue eyes. Beside him was Gibbon, fine-featured and trim-bearded. I found myself thinking how many eminent soldiers are strikingly handsome men, as who should know better than I. Custer sat at one end of the table, gloomy and watchful, his fingers drumming softly. Others present were Marsh and Campbell of the ship, Reno, young Bradley the scout officer, old grasshopper Jim Brisbane of the 2nd Cavalry, lonesome Charlie Reynolds, Custer's chief scout, with his arm in a sling, and a dozen or so others I've forgotten. A steward was serving coffee, and I recall Terry remarking how he'd tried to give up sugar, but couldn't, and his spoon tinkling in the cup as we waited. "Well, gentlemen," says he, "tomorrow we take the field in earnest. Major Reno and Mr. Bradley have carried out separate reconnaissances, and we have reason to believe that hostile bands have moved west to cross Rosebud Creek in the direction of the Big Horn Hills. The best estimate suggests that not more than 800 or 1,000 braves are to be reckoned with, perhaps 3,000 Indians all told. Now, we dispose above 1,000 cavalry and 600 infantry, in addition to General Crook's force of 1,300 to the south, so, pardon, General," it was young Bradley, a keen-looking hand, "those 3,000 hostiles, aren't those agency figures calculated during the winter?" Terry said yes, but they could be relied on. Bradley feared they might be low, since many Indians might have left the agencies with the arrival of spring. "I've seen sign of about 2,000 to 3,000 myself up there, you see, sir," says he apologetically, "and I doubt if they're the only hostiles in the Powder River country." "Me likewise, General." This was Reynolds, Custer's scout, an innocent-looking youth who was talked of as a latter-day Carson. "Agency figures don't signify. There could be twice they're reckoning up yonder. Easy." "Well, they are the only figures we have to go on," says Terry. "Shall we say possibly 5,000? It won't hurt to err on the safe side." 5,000 braves," insists Reynolds. "Never mind women and young." "You don't know that," says Gibbon. "I don't not know it, Colonel," says Reynolds doggedly, and there were chuckles. Custer spoke up sharply. 5,000 or 10, Charlie, it makes no difference, since they'll be in divers bands, and we are more than a match for them if they're all together." With that settled, Terry went on to say that he and Gibbon would march up the Big Horn to intercept the Indian force, whose trail Reno had seen heading that way. With Crook advancing from the south, the hostiles would be caught front and rear. Meanwhile, Custer and his cavalry would have passed up the Rosebud to cut off the hostiles if they tried to slip out of the trap. QED, and any questions? "Where's Crook?" asks someone. "So far as we know," answers Terry, "somewhere in the region of the headwaters of Rosebud Creek or Little Big Horn River, which, unfortunately," he added, peering at the map, "are not clearly indicated here. About there, wouldn't you say, Brisbane?" Grasshopper Jim nodded and made vague crosses on the map, and everyone took a squint. "His exact position is not of too much import," continued Terry, "since he too has his scouts and will be closing on the same quarry as ourselves." What none of us knew, of course, was that while Crook was indeed around the head of the Rosebud, he wasn't feeling too happy about it, since 4 days earlier Crazy Horse had bushwhacked him and fought him to a standstill. But why should any of us suspect such a thing? These were the Indians who weren't going to fight, you remember? "Ideally, our force and General Crook's would converge on the hostiles simultaneously," says Terry, "but in the absence of communications, that is too much to hope for." Custer lifted his head. "I'm to prevent any escape of hostiles to the east, sir." His voice was casual. "If they're around the Big Horn, it's certain my cavalry will be there before Colonel Gibbon's infantry." Terry nodded, lifting a finger. Precisely, I was coming to that. If you find the Indian trail leading towards the Bighorn, you should pass it by and go south towards the Bighorn itself. Thus, you will be in position south of the hostiles, while Colonel Gibbon approaches from the north, and it should be possible for you to act together. It may be that you will encounter Cook en route, so much the better. But in any event, our endeavor must be to act in concert so far as can be. It may prove impossible, since our objective is not a fixed one. We can't be certain where the hostiles will be found. One thing was clear. Teddy wanted no action against the Sioux until Gibbon was in position. But equally clearly, he had to allow his commanders some discretion, since in such an uncertain operation, no one could foresee what emergencies or opportunities might arise. Everyone in the cabin understood that. But there was one man there with a special interest in forcing Terry to say it aloud. "If I encounter hostiles," says Custer slowly, "before Colonel Gibbon has come up..." He left it there, leaning forward as though to examine the map, and it seemed to me he was avoiding Terry's eye and waiting for him to complete the sentence. And Terry, willy-nilly, spoke the fatal words, so amiably, so reasonably. I think back to that moment. Custer apparently intent on the map. Gibbon half turned towards Terry, who was sitting back in his chair, choosing his words. And compare it with another moment. Lucan's face red with indignation under Causeway Heights, and Lou Nolan fairly bouncing in his saddle with impatience. "There, my lord, the guns. There's your enemy." There had been fury and passion. Here was calm and polite discussion, but they both led to the same end. Bloody catastrophe. "You must use your own judgment, of course," says Terry, nodding. "It's not possible to give definite instructions, but you know my intentions. Conform to them unless you see sufficient reason to depart from them." In other words, please yourself. That's what Terry was saying, what he was bound to say, and Custer could throw it in the teeth of any court-martial. Terry was having to trust to Custer's common sense, and he knew as well as I did what a questionable commodity that might be. But he couldn't put that into words. A Sam Grant or a Colin Campbell could have said, "See here, Custer, you know what I want, and I know what you want, and how you'll interpret my orders to suit yourself, and claim afterwards I justified you. Very good, we understand each other, and if you play the fool, by God, I'll break you." But Terry, the gentle, kindly Terry, couldn't say that. And really, was there the need? It was just a simple operation against a few hostile bands, after all. Custer said nothing more. He'd got what he wanted, and now he was studiously watching Brisbane pushing pins into the map to mark the rosebud route, and joining them with a blue pencil. Gibbon, with a glance at Custer, said something about there being no need for a precipitate attack, unless it was necessary, of course, and Terry interrupted. "I hope there will be no need of any such thing as an attack. Our object is to bring these people under control to the agencies, to capture, not to conquer." Custer was sketching idly with a pencil now, chin in hand. But he roused himself when Gibbon offered to lend him some troops of the 2nd Cavalry. "Thank you, Colonel, but any force of hostiles that is too big for the 7th will be too big for the 7th and 4 troops." Which was as silly a remark as I've ever heard. No, he didn't want the Gatlings either, since they might impede his march. Terry didn't press him. I guess the last thing he wanted was Custer loose about the place with machine guns. There was more talk, but that in essence was the famous Far West Conference, and no one was in much doubt what it amounted to. I heard young Bradley's aside as the senior men departed. "Well, guess who's going to get there first and win the laurels? Who, the 7th Cavalry? No, you don't say." My own view confirmed when I loafed out on deck and heard Custer down at his tent, firing off orders to his troop commanders and sounding deuced peevish about it. "I tell you, Moylan, I know better than you what a pack mule can carry, and I'll have 15 days' rations and 50 reserve rounds per carbine. Yes, in addition to the 100 rounds for each man and 25 for the pistols, mind. Well, Captain Benteen, you are responsible for your own company. The extra forage is only a suggestion, but remember that we may have to follow the trail for 2 weeks, no matter how far it takes us, so you'd better take extra salt. We may have to live on horse meat before we're through. I saw him stamp into his tent as the others dismissed, and mooched down for a look-see. He was alone, chewing at a pen, but at sight of me he grinned. Well, you come along after all? His eyes were exultant now. This is going to be a 7th Cavalry battle, my boy. Gatlings, indeed. I have more respect for Crazy Horse than that, I hope. I declined again, and he teased me, but in a nervous, restless way that showed his mind was anywhere but here. I knew he'd held himself in at the conference, but now that the rain was off, there was an almost furtive quality about his excitement. It wasn't quite canny, and presently I wished him luck, and left him calling, high-pitched, for Kioch and Yates, almost before I was out of the tent. Back on board, there was a great poker school underway in the saloon, which lasted until daybreak, so I made the most of the fellows' company while they were still there, and picked up a copper or two, neglecting Mrs. Candy with the thought that there would be ample time for her in the quiet days ahead. Castor was off at first light, the long blue and brown squadrons moving slowly out of bivouac in the misty dawn. The Rosebud is little more than a brook, where it joins the Yellowstone, running between green banks with a hedgerow down one side. Again, I could have imagined it was an English meadow as the troops wheeled up the little stream. Castor, fussing over the pack train, paused to shake Terry's hand and receive a clap on the back from Gibbon, who told him to mind and leave some redskins for the rest of the column. "Don't be too greedy, George," cries he, and Custer snapped a reply at him and rode off. I heard Terry say something about eagerness, and Gibbon shrugged and said, "At that, we'd look regular fools if they were to escape after all this. Three columns to round up a few stray Sioux and Cheyenne." That was their preoccupation, you see. Not Custer, but the possibility that the expedition might wear itself out chasing hostiles who wouldn't fight or surrender, but simply melt away into the desolation of the Bighorn. Far west was to move down to the Bighorn mouth now, to ferry Gibbon's infantry across. And it would be the following night that we moored in a wooded reach, under the loom of a huge bluff that reared up along the southern shore. It was a perfect balmy evening. The boat was quiet now, with only Terry's staff men aboard, and I was smoking a cheroot at the main deck rail, considering what drill I'd go through with Mrs. Candy that night, when here she came from the saloon, very stately in her crimson, with a white silk scarf over her head and shoulders. We talked idly about the possibility that Marsh would be taking Far West back east for fresh supplies shortly, and I found myself regretting that soon our business honeymoon would be over. I'm like that, you see. I get fond of women. And while I'd been happy just to stallion away by night and be spared any cloying intimacy during the day, still it's pleasant when a tough piece like this one begins to show interest in your more spiritual qualities. For in the past day or so it had seemed to me that Mrs. Candy had been thawing a little. She'd been readier to talk about matters other than business, the weather, for example, and she'd even asked me a question or two about England. Now, at the rail, she admired the rising moon with modified rapture. "That's beautiful, yep," drew my attention to what she called the trees and all, and took me quite aback by laying a hand on my arm. I thought she was indicating that it was time for another protracted thrash in my cabin, but she sighed and said, "It's such a lovely night, I guess I'll like a stroll, okay?" We descended to the steerage and the main plank to the bank, where the crew had set up a temporary forge, now deserted, and presently we were pacing slowly under the trees, and I was describing nights in India and China, while she murmured an occasional, or "don't say," leaning easily on my arm. It was quite delightful. The air was warm, the groves were dim in shadow, with moonlight in the glades, and the river lapped gently at the reeds. We walked a furlong or so and paused under the spreading branches. I looked at her face framed in the white scarf and the dark line of the patch across her eye, and for the first time felt a tremor of pity for that disfigurement. She was such a magnificent creature. It was a damn shame. And I took her in my arms and kissed her fondly, out of sheer affection. Well, for a moment anyway, before my better nature prevailed, and I began to grapple her bottom. She fended me off gently, and slipped the scarf from her head, swinging it in her hand as we walked on. "You're a strange man," says she, which is a sure sign that they want something. "You've been so many places, seen so many things. Yep, lots of women in your life, I guess." Modestly, I admitted that I'd seldom been solitary for long, and said that I suppose neither had she. "Sure, I've known a lot of men. Too many," she shrugged. "Guess I'll go on knowing a lot more. Too many more. Yep." I said she didn't sound overjoyed at the prospect. "Why should I? Men are trash, pretty much. Yep. All they want is to use women in bed." She paced slowly, glancing up at the purple sky. "And money. Women and money, and they spend them both as selfishly as they know how. Okay." "Well, thank you, ma'am. Women have purer motives, I suppose." "Some women, sometimes. Some women are soft and fool themselves that one of these days they'll meet a man who doesn't just want to spend them. They're wrong." She stopped, and to my astonishment I saw there was a tear coursing down from her left eye. Suddenly I remembered the sound of sobbing from her cabin the first night, and caught her hand. "Heavens above, whatever's the matter?"
"It's nothing."
She pulled her hand free and turned sharply to face me.
"You're not any different, are you? What's wrong? Good Lord, look here. If I've misunderstood..." "Oh, no,"
says she, composing herself.
"You've understood, all right. You understood from the minute I walked by the brevet. Yep, you understood. Gee, that's worth mounting. Yes, sir, that's prime. I could use that."
"Well, of course I did," I agreed, slightly bewildered. "So did you, didn't you?" She ignored the question.
"That's the way you always look at women, isn't it? The face, is it beautiful? If it's disfigured, does that matter? The rest, the waist and hips and breasts and legs, they're what matter, isn't that so?" "Okay. And will she? And if she does, what will it cost me? Can I get it for free? What's it worth?"
The contempt in her tone nettled and amazed me, and I thought she'd been melting.
"Well, since I've just had dinner, I'd rather you didn't tell me how a lecherous female assesses her lovers. But my experience leads me to believe it's in exactly the same way. In your own case, your interest in me hasn't been precisely sentimental. How old you now?"
This was too much.
"Oh, come now, you haven't been a charming little ray of sunshine, exactly, have you? Provided I kept you happy in the night watches, which from your conduct I believe I did." "What the devil," I demanded, "is all this about? Am I at fault because I haven't serenaded under your porter or given proofs of undying devotion? Don't tell me that you... Well, that wasn't part of our bargain, surely."
She was looking askance, and damn it, there were the tears again. She was absolutely weeping. And from under her patch, too. Interesting, that. But God help me if I understand women.
"Mind you," I lied, consoling like, "I won't say I haven't..."
But she lifted her hand.
"No, don't give me that, okay?"
She took a deep breath.
"You're certainly right. Yep, I'm being a fool."
I'd not have believed it, not of her. The most unlikely females have gone moony over me, but I'd never have credited that this one had any thought beyond pork and beans. God knew she hadn't let on, until now, anyway, if that's what she was doing.
"Most of all, I'm a fool for wasting time," she said quietly. "I never thought I would, not with you. But just for a moment there, I felt a grief that I had thought long dead. A grief for someone else, someone I loved dearly long ago. Oh, yes, I've been in love. But it ended on just such a night as this. Warm and soft and beautiful."
The hairs prickled on my neck suddenly. This wasn't Mrs. Cannon.
Andy talking, the voice, as well as the words, were different. The nasal Yankee twang had disappeared. A night when I was happier than I'd ever been because the man I loved had promised to take me out of slavery, and I was hastening to him with joy in my heart in a garden in Santa Fe. For several heartbeats it meant nothing, and then it hit me like a blow. But whereas I'd have acted instantly at a physical assault, probably by flight, the implication of what she said when I grasped it so shocked my mind that I stood numb, incapable of movement. Even when she lifted the scarf abruptly and I saw that she was looking beyond me and heard the rush of running feet suddenly upon me, and I knew that here was terrible, deadly danger. By then it was too late. Sinewy hands were at my throat and wrists. Rank, greased bodies were all about me. Nightmare painted faces glared in the moonlight. And as I stretched my mouth to scream, a handful of cloth was thrust into it, and a binder whipped round my face. I heaved in panic, choking on my buried scream as rawhide bit into my wrists. It was done in a twinkling, and I was helpless, held by a half-naked brave on either side, while two others, steel in their hands, hovered alert. My eyes rolled in terror back to her, not believing this monstrous, impossible thing, because it was impossible. She had not moved. She stood tall and straight in the moonlight, the scarf at her side. Then she reached up and took the patch from her face, and I saw that the eye beneath it was sound and bright. She cupped it a moment with her hand, and then she shook her head and came a step closer, her face almost against mine. "Yes, look well," she said. "Cleone." She was lying. She must be. It could not be true. Cleone was... where? After 25 years... And she'd been middling tall and slender, while this woman was near 6 feet and statuesque, and had a bold, full face with heavy lips and chin. And Cleone had been a negress. I stared, refusing to believe, while the bright, dark eyes bored into mine. And then I caught beneath the full flesh of middle age a fleeting glimpse of the sweet, nun-like face of long ago. Saw how the dusky high colour might be no more than cosmetic covering on a skin that time had darkened from the pale cream of the octoroon. How that damnable patch had disguised the shape of her face. But the voice, the manner, the whole being of the woman was so utterly unlike the girl I had... And as the memory of what I had done rushed back, she whispered softly, "En passant par la Lorraine, avec mes sabots." And the bile of terror came up behind my gag. "You recognize me now, the girl you were going to take to Mexico. I probably had no need of this." And she held up the patch. "After all, what should a woman look like who has endured 25 years of slavery in the hands of the Navajo? She should be dead, unless she's unlucky enough to be alive, when she should be a wrinkled, withered hag, a verminous shell of a living thing." Her voice was choking. "A poor, mad ghost crippled by beatings and starvation and terror of the hell she has been through." Her eyes were blazing like coals, and her hand came up, nails crooked as though to rake my face. There were tears running down her cheeks again, tears of rage and hate. "You bastard! You filthy, degraded, cowardly, evil, cruel, 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 cruel." It wailed away in a shuddering gasp, and her clawed hand went over her own face to stifle the great sobs that shook her. The fit passed, and she wiped her cheeks and lifted her face again. "That is what she should look like," she whispered. "An old miserable skeleton, not at all like the splendid Mrs. Candy. No, if you ever gave a thought to what Cleone must have become, you couldn't have imagined anything like Mrs. Candy, and you would hardly recognize in her the child of 18. You sold for $2,000 to the priest of Santa Fe." So he'd blabbed, the lousy little Judas. I might have known. But no, it was impossible. It was a nightmare. This could not be, must not be, Cleone. But I had to be sure. Oh, I had to be sure. So, she slipped the eye patch on again. "Mrs. Candy, you see, and Mr. Comer, that was the name, was it not? How often I wondered, waited and hated and wondered what had become of him. And after 25 years I learned that he was the Harry Flashman, English gentleman. I didn't believe it until I came to New York to see for myself. Then I knew, but you haven't changed. No, no. Still the same handsome, arrogant, swaggering foulness who used me and lied to me and betrayed me. You haven't changed. But then you haven't been a prisoner of savages, a tortured, degraded slave. Not yet.
One of the Sioux grunted, pointing there through the trees with the steamboat lights and a distant voice, and I couldn't utter a sound. She spoke again in fluent Sioux, and
no danger. No one saw us. No one will see me go back.
I writhed in their grip, trying to plead with my eyes to beg her to remove that beastly gag so that I could explain. Christ, I'd swear truth out of America if only she'd let me. She must. I bulged my eyes in dumb entreaty, and she shook her head.
No, I have the truth, you see, and nothing you could say could alter it. We both know how you betrayed and sold a girl who loved and trusted you. Oh, yes, she loved you. If she had not...
Her eye was fierce with angry tears again, and her voice trembled.
It would not have hurt so much. And I could never have hated as I do now if I had not loved once. You see?
She steadied and went on.
I could have had you killed in New York for $50, but it would have been too easy. Yep.
The vibrant Creole voice which had whispered like velvet and shaken with passion was gone, and in its place the nasal Yankee of Mrs. Candy, cold and flat as a mortuary slab, and all the more frightening because it was without emotion. She might have been discussing some new sexual activity, or the Bismarck Project. Jesus, Bismarck, and the letter and the corporation. My brain whirled with it all, and her voice cut through it like a knife. I'm not gonna waste time, just enough to let you know how I come to be here, so that when I go back to the boat and you go where you're going, you'll be able to appreciate the justice of it. Okay.
She broke abruptly into Sioux and set his back against that tree, the light on his face.
They threw me brutally against the tree and held me. She came in front of me and I began to blubber in panic, for in that merciless, beautiful face I could see Nariman in the dungeon, Rana Valona staring down from her balcony. The Amazon women, when they caught that poor bastard on the Tahomey Creek, oh God, was she going to set about me? I couldn't bear it, I'd go mad.